In nature's scheme of things, there are certain plants which are carnivorous, or eating plants. The Venus flytrap is one of the best known of these plants. A fly, drawn to the plant by a sweet syrup, brushes against trigger bristles. Just how these plants digest their prey has yet to be explained. There is much still to learn about these fascinating eating plants. This is a newcomer, Tripidus celestis, brought to Earth on the meteorites during the Day of the Triffids.
Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. No set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. Just a quick announcement about I've not released that many podcasts, but I've actually been doing like plenty of reading. I'm like three books behind, but due to this being another special episode with Juliana, say hi Juliana.
Hi.
We decided to just record this one first because this book and media is still fresh on our minds. The book is The Day of the Triffids, as you already know by listening to the introduction there. That's actually a little clip from the 19... Let's have a quick look across back on there on YouTube here. It's The Day of the Triffids movie from 1962, I think it is. And I included that little clip there. Maybe I included that clip when I did a previous review of this book. I can't remember because it's a movie which now exists in the public domain. Anyone can watch it or do anything that they want with it, so I decided to just include a clip there. Anyway, as I said, I've reviewed this book already on the podcast way back on episode number 32. I did a full review of this book. So if you're just looking for a normal book review of John Wyndham's The Day of the Triffids, it's probably best to pause this and listen to episode number 32, which is probably from like the first or second year, probably the second year that I did this podcast. And now it's the sixth year I've been doing this podcast. I thought I'll revisit this book, mainly because Juliana was like, hey, what book shall I read? And you subscribed to... Well, tell us, what was that a service that you subscribed to that you tried out on your iPad?
So, yeah, because buying books, buying ebooks all the time can get quite expensive because they're not actually cheaper than buying normal books, first of all. So I decided to register for a free... No, for not free, library...
It's like a subscription service.
It's like a library of books where you can get books to read and then give them back.
Oh, yeah, so it's not free, you pay monthly fee.
Yeah, it's 10 euros for a month, and I thought, oh, I just tried out, they have a 14 days trial.
Yeah, and so you looked for science fiction, and along with all the Perry Rhodan...
Perry Rhodan. Yeah. We should do a Perry Rhodan episode.
No, we shouldn't.
I'd found the Day of the Triffids in there.
In German.
In German as an ebook, which is like really impressive. But because of that and because of the point that I thought, well, paying 10 euros for a library service for ebooks, and these ebooks weren't actually that... It wasn't a big variety of these.
Yeah, there wasn't, because you were saying, oh, this would be fine. I was like, this is a really bad selection. You're like, oh, look, there's Charles Stross. And I'm like, yeah, he does some good books. And then you're like, and then later on you're like, oh, here's that book I already read. And here's this other book that I already read. And there's like, oh, yeah, and there's this one book by Ian M. Banks. It's like, if you're signing up for a library service and they have one book by Ian M. Banks that you've already read, it probably wasn't going to be bad. So yeah. You don't actually have your copy of your book anymore because you deleted the app.
Because I deleted it and I didn't actually go to pay 10 euros a month
for. But you got the book for free.
I got it for free and I read it, and I must admit I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
especially because I just finished, spoiler, Solaris beforehand.
Yeah,
and compared to Solaris, that book actually starts really... Yeah, you get some
In Solaris?
Action. No.
Oh.
In the Day of the Triffids.
Yes. I was going to say yes. So our next episode that we're going to do together is the Solaris episode, but we've still got one movie to watch to do that to get into that one. Let's start talking about the Day of the Triffids. We'll start off with the book and the German translation that you got as well. I've already reviewed the main book, but it starts off, there's like these two basic science fictional concepts which come together into an apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic. Well, I guess it's post-apocalyptic because it starts post-apocalypse in a way. The first one are these meteors coming down from the sky, but you're not really sure if they're meteors. It's all a bit like, ooh, conspiracy, ooh, weird stuff like that. What are these flashing lights in the sky? Not really sure. It's never really explained. But at the time, the explanation is, yes, we're passing through the tail of a comet, or we're passing through a meteor storm, and there's these rocks coming in, and they're flashing across the sky, and it's an amazing thing, and everyone stays up late and watches these flashing lights coming in. And then there's a blinding flash, and everyone is blind, except some of our heroes are not blind as well. For example,
yeah, the first hero we met is, what's his name?
His name's Bill Mason, and the book begins, chapter one, the end begins. It goes, when a day that you happen to know is Wednesday starts off sounding like a Sunday, there is something seriously wrong somewhere, which is a great first line.
I really enjoyed this first sentence. It's really good fun.
Yeah. I remember in my previous review that I did of this, I'm sure I quoted that as well. And that's the thing. So you get up and everyone's blind except the guy who starts off. He's in a hospital and he's got bandages around his eyes because he has been hit by the spraying sting of a triffid. And a triffid is a big, tall plant. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know what a triffid is. Maybe you've never done this, but anyway, there's going to be massive spoilers later on in this podcast. We'll tell you when we get to the spoiler part anyway. So a triffid is like 7 foot tall plant. It's got it's like the height of it. What does it say in the book? It's the height of a sunflower. It's got the bulb of a turnip down the bottom. Mm. It's got the hairiness of a thing. It's got the thing of a Venus flytrap. Yeah. It's got a tentacle-like whip.
Like a sting thing.
Like a stinging whip and a thing like a nettle and a thistle. And and then you put all these different bits and pieces of plants together and you get what a triffid is. And the most important thing is that they are stinging. They have a whip that they sting. And the second the most important thing is that they're moving plants. They're walking plants. They have these three legs at the bottom, which is why they're called the triffids. And a conversation is recounted, I think in like the second or third chapter in the book, where Bill Mason, he used to work with triffids. He worked on a triffid farm. He was a biologist. He looked after these things and studied these things. And he has a conversation. He's saying, in the conversation with this other guy is saying, someone he's working with, saying, well, you know, if it came down to it, if I was a blind man or a normal triffid, the triffid will be able to get past the blind man, no problem at all, because the only thing that humans have over anything else in the world is sight. It's because we can see this very narrow range of, I'm quoting the book here, we can see this very narrow range of frequency bandwidth or whatever it is, and it gets into your eyes, and that's all we have. And as soon as that is taken away, humans are worse than children, or as you know, less than children. You know, and if you're already blind, you'll be better in the world of blind men. It's not even like the one-eyed man is king. It kind of is anyway. But the point is, the triffids is king. So once everyone in London and in the wider world goes blind, the triffids take over. And the Day of the Triffids is pretty much like one guy's adventure of going around London, getting out of London, and then trying to find a girl that he's met up with to and then trying to establish kind of a post-apocalyptic life together.
They can't just escape, because nobody else.
Yeah, there's nowhere to escape to. Yeah, where are you going to?
And it starts really well as like the story has like a really high uprising tension.
Yeah, kind it of starts bit. Off.
Yeah,
it starts off because Bill Mason, he's worked with triffids a lot before. He knows how dangerous they are. He's been stung by them in the past. He had one when he was a child. He had one landed in his one started growing in his backyard and things like that.
But so he hit him when he was quite young. So he actually has some kind of
He's got some, because he's worked with him so much and he's got sprayed in the face and hit on the arm and all that kind of stuff. Yes, he does
he's
have a little
immune
bit
immune against
little not, bit immune to it.
Not completely, but a bit.
When he gets stung, they say, well, what, why, you know, the person who's with us, like, why didn't you die straight away? He was like, oh, look, the poison sacs are already empty on this one. You know, it's used up its poison, and also I have an immunity to it. Mm-hmm. So it kind of just stings him. So he does have an advantage, but one of his main advantages, he knows about triffids. And when these bands of people are trying to get back together again, and it's like, hey, we're going to go here, and we need this, and we need that, and we need this. And he's like, oh, and I've got this whole truckload of triffid gear. I've got triffid masks, I've got triffid gloves, I've got triffid guns. guns. I've got shotguns to blow the tops of the Triffids off. I've got flamethrowers. I have all these anti-Triffid stuff. And they're like, eh, probably don't need that. You know, why are you doing that? You know, it's the last on this. We'll pack that if we really need it. And then later on, I think it's in the last one of the last things in the book. It's like, oh, yeah. And this guy said, I'm very sorry for not listening to you about the Triffids. Because in the end, the Triffids were the main thing. You know, if it was just a book about lots of people going blind and getting by, that'd be okay.
Yeah.
But also, it's not just about people going blind. It's not just about the Triffids. There is a lot more going on in this book, which is hinted at quite strongly at the beginning. It's like, this is very much a Cold War book. You can read it now and it doesn't feel like a Cold War book. But when you're reading it, you're like, oh, this entire thing, the world going blind and the Triffids turning up, is a, you know, like a Soviet plot. Didn't you get that at all?
No.
Well, that's... Look, all the way through, you get these people going, oh, what are the flashing lights in the sky? Well, we were told it was a meteor, but was it really a meteor? And you get news reports from, you know, all the way around the world and, you know, and here and there and things like that. And so you get the idea, I mean, one of the things, I'm talking conspiracy theories, and it's kind of mentioned the conspiracy theories, that the things that are raining down during that time, like the, they were going, well, this wasn't typhoid, because typhoid doesn't hit, you know, when people start getting ill in London, of course, and they say, yeah, there's this plague, and this plague just turns up out of nowhere, and you're like, well, was this chemical warfare, not chemical war, like germ warfare by the Soviets? Because at the beginning it's saying like, well, we're the Americans and we don't have any bombs in space, and these other countries are like, we don't have any either, and they're like, well, you don't have a rocket program, why are you doing this? And then but nobody else says that, and you think, well, why is he setting that up right at the beginning of the book?
Yeah, and also like you mean about also the idea with the, where did the Triffids come from the, and they,
well,
had
it's pretty
this Russian.
Yeah, it's pretty well established. Well established that the Russians come. I'm quite sure in the original book it mentions that there's the character. Well, I said character. The Lysenko. Maybe I'll be able to find it here. Who is but maybe that was in a radio adaptation. I saw it on Wikipedia just now. But yeah, it's sort of like, oh, you put them together. I can't see it here. I'm trying to look through this book. No, it doesn't actually mention Lysenko here. Maybe on that page. Anyway, so the idea being that this whole thing is the Russians are wiping out the rest of them because they can send down these flashy things and they can send down the flashing lights above all of the cities at the same time to blind everybody, because you never get any reports from Russia. But Russia obviously knows how to deal with the Triffids, and this is another picture of a Triffid, look. And also Russia maybe told everyone to stay inside and cover their eyes and put a bucket over their head when the flashing light was going to come. So maybe Russia's getting on fine with it and slowly encroaching across Germany and just waiting a few years. It never comes out that way, but you also realise that the disease that comes down, the Triffids that come down, and the flashing lights in the sky might have all been space weaponry going wrong, or at least the flashes in the sky and the germs coming down might have been space, like, orbital stuff going wrong.
But, like, what do you think? Like, when an author writes something in 1951, it was already about Russians and Americans?
It wasn't really there, but I mean, it's 1951, but it was mentioned. It's quite strongly mentioned, like, okay, this is Russia. Like, at the beginning, it's like, it's still America versus Russia. Russia, there's got the Iron Curtain, or, well, I'm not even sure the name Iron Curtain was there at that time. But he had to explain, when you send a rocket far enough into space, if it keeps going fast enough, it doesn't fall down and it orbits around the world. He actually had to explain that, because this book is written in 1951, and orbits aren't really well known. I remember reading this, I think I've mentioned this before in the podcast, that I read this, I was flicking through this textbook, the school textbook from like the 1950s or whatever it was, and it was like, maybe one day we'll have planes that can fly high enough that we can bounce signals off them to get across the sea or to get across the ocean. We'll be able to, because they'll be that high, they'll be flying that high, and I'm just like, look, just ask Arthur C. Clarke, geosynchronous orbits, that's all we need. We need like three satellites and we can reach that. Anyway, so that's what's going on in my head, you know. But it's funny when you read these older science fiction, from 1951, it's like 60 years old, over 60 years old, and you realise, oh, they actually had to explain, you know, if you breed stuff like this, you know, and that kind of, or if, well, it's maybe not the breeding, but like there's this whole... you know, doing this and doing that. But I also really like about the Triffids is that it's all about oil at the beginning. It's like, and this oil company, yes, we'll be able to do this and we'll be able to do this. So you've got this kind of little bit of like exploiting the earth in the way. And that, of course, this is very much about the men, me and play gods,
But I must admit, when I read this book, the pictures I had in mind when I read it wasn't... it weren't pictures of a world in the 50s, actually. Like, I mean, they go in cars and in trucks and
they
all that
give
stuff.
Each other cigarettes and stuff like
yeah.
that.
But in my head, they were just like, the story took place in the modern world for me.
Yeah.
Which is, I know it's it might be weird to say, but it is. So they actually just had like a modern truck, like a big modern truck, and like a normal car. We had like a car we would drive now, not like a 50s car.
But at one point the truck breaks down and he gets out and he manages to fix the carburetor. In the modern day,
of course
I wouldn't be able to do this. But anyone who could drive knew how to open up the hood of the car or the bonnet of the car, whatever you want to say, and poke around inside. Like and I've had that same kind of thing.
He worked in like in some agriculture.
He was a biology guy.
Yeah, but like, yeah, might be possible that you have access to these kind of knowledge.
To be honest, when I read this book, because the first time I read this book or the first time I knew about Triffids was, you know, I guess I probably read this book in the 1980s or early 1990s for the first time, I guess. So because this is a long time favorite of mine, this book. I always imagine stuff being set in the 80s. You know, that's what I have in my brain. Yeah. It's like when the first time that you read this kind of stuff. But
that shows actually how timeless this story is. It's not like in War of the Worlds when I read the original H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
It actually was that I had the
You're in Victorian England.
I was
very
in Victorian,
much so. Yes.
Totally.
There's trains and steamboats
exactly,
and stuff
yeah.
like that. Yeah.
And women always wearing dresses and stuff all the time. But in this book, it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm in the 50s. I'm in like,
No, but there are still some very 50s sensibilities like, and now here's the woman. And she's now the
but
love
not so
of...
much.
Yeah.
She's quite, what's her name? Joelle.
Gisella.
In German, it's Joelle.
Gisella. Gisella here. In the audiobook
Gisella,
that
yeah,
I listened
Gisella.
To, it was more Gisella rather than Gisella, yeah.
Okay, but she's like actually quite a...
Yeah, she knows what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, she's quite independently thinking.
Yes, that's true. And I actually really quite like her character, and it's a great way that she's... it's like a... I know this... I'm not sure if this is a comment by John Wyndham. It's sort of like, oh, this young rebellious girl, she wrote a book called Sex is My Adventure. And then everyone knows her name because it's like the biggest selling book and it becomes a movie and everything like that. You know, obviously some kind of... Was it the 50 Shades of Grey book? It was the 50 Shades of Grey book at the same time, and people would read that and go, oh, you wrote 50 Shades of Grey. It's literally that kind of author. Sex is My Adventure. And it's the scandalous book, and it gets banned from all these libraries.
Everybody knows it.
Everybody knows it. Nobody's read it. Oh, well, nobody in the book seems to have read it. One person seems to have...
Yeah, but some people are like...
Either way.
Oh, it's you. Ah.
Yeah. Anyway, this is the thing. But, of course... Once the apocalypse happens and people go, oh, you are the author of, and there's, of course, spoilers for later on the book. It's like, oh, yes, my son is David. You know, I'm the author of David. And he's like, oh, yes, I just saw him, the first edition. I like this kind of, you know. So it's weird that she's this free, independent woman making her way in the world and using her sexuality and all this kind of for her benefit and all that kind of stuff. And then by the end of the book, it's like, now you get in the kitchen and have babies. You know, it feels a little bit like that at some point.
Yeah, but at the beginning when they actually go to her parents' house, and then oh no, it's not her parents, but like when they go into that house, which is like a really nice expensive apartment or something, and then he asks her if she can cook, and she said like pretty much she said
boiled eggs.
Yeah, so I don't know so much about America in the, no, it's not America, it's stupid. But I don't know so much about the 50s, actually.
Yes, but you do get get that scene where, again, we're into spoiler territory now. So if you have not read this book, just go and read the book and then come back and listen to the end of this, because it's worth reading. But there's this part where there's the two rival groups, and there's one which is... Don't press that, because that stopped. There's these two groups. So one which is saying, hey, we should all do this, and women are the most important things now because we need to start rebuilding. And this is like one day afterwards or 2 days afterwards, and like, we're going to start rebuilding. And the other one's just like, no, we can't have women having sex. You have to get married first. And then when you get married, and there'll be one man and one woman and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And no free love. And he's like, I'm not talking free love. I'm talking about survival. Yeah.
This other group is like the total opposite. Like, so the religious guy, they meet them later, but the group they meet beforehand is like, oh yeah, and like a man should get as many women around him as possible.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't. Yeah. It's this weird thing that one of them was very practical about it. It's like,
yeah,
we're not going to have any blind men, because blind men can't have babies, but blind women can have babies, and they'll be sighted babies. So it's sighted men and lots of blind women, because we've got to get the population. And you'd read that and you go, well, that's realistic. And in the end, that's what they needed to do. It's one of those weird things that you just go, oh, okay, let's go for it then. So yes, I do think some of the sensibilities in this are a little bit dated, but it is 1951, and it's, I think even for its time, it's pretty good there. So moving on to actually the post-apocalyptic part, or did you want to talk more about the adventure part at the beginning?
I really enjoyed that. What? Like how he then goes into supermarkets and gets stuff and put it in trucks.
Yes, because all the time you're thinking, well, what would I do?
Yeah, exactly. And this is like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. And you should go for that. And if anything happens, you should always have like candles and big water things. Yeah. And he thinks his way of getting onto it is very practical and he's very... Like, it almost feels as if he's experienced in that.
No, but there's some points where you realise, oh, he isn't experienced, when he's when the next morning Gisella has been out and she's got walking boots and hiking boots and hiking trousers and a hiking jacket and a coat, and she looks fabulous because she's fabulous. You know, she's got this upper class socialite. But when she gets dressed up to go out and stuff, and he's like, oh, I've just got my dinner jacket on from last night and my shoes, you know, like just normal shoes that I picked up from this place. And you go, oh, all right.
Where you can see that women actually think a lot more about clothes than men do.
Yeah, but it's not just about clothes, but he wasn't thinking practical. Like, he really should have been putting on boots. Like, you know, I've got my summer boots and my winter in Berlin boots and my trainers, you know, and stuff like that. And it's like he had flip-flops on and she had, you know, winter Berlin boots, you know, and just she was ready for walking across broken glass and all that other kind of stuff, and he wasn't. So yeah, all this time where you think that he's the greatest guy, but he's, you know, he's getting by, but all the time, like, he has to learn how to be a farmer, he's got to learn how to be a mechanic, he learns this, his knowledge, his expertise is in Triffids, and then he meets other people like Croker. Is it Croker, one of the guys? I'm not sure what it's called in German, but the guy who first attacks the university and then later sets up his own,
and then,
they meet
back
up
to them and say, oh yeah, what I did there wasn't that good idea.
Yeah, well, he says it was a good idea, but we couldn't have known the plague, and we couldn't have known nobody was coming to help at all, but we had to do something.
Yeah.
And it's great. And I really like that character, because you're like, no, because you follow him to know where the moral line is, you know, and at some points, Mason is with Croker, and sometimes, you know, he isn't, and he tries to get away, but all the time he's like going between the, okay, ignore the rest of the world, fuck all the blind people, except take some blind people to fuck, and we'll go over here and set up here, and we're going to set up the new world. And then there's the other, oh, we've got to look after the blind people, we've got to do the best, we've got to, you know, and there's different kind
but
of things.
What I really enjoy also about it is that actually when something like that happens, no rules that we have in our society now count anymore.
Well, they even say that in the book.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that when the, is that this Croak? What?
Croker?
Croker guy, when he first helped the blind people and said a group of blind people should have a seeing person to guide them around.
Yeah, 1 to 10.
And then at the end he actually realizes, even if I would like to do it like that, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I like it how it's not like this black and white, because it can happen that you just suddenly have to change your opinion about something.
Yeah.
So I really like how he plays these different characters in these different directions.
Yeah, it works out well. But I do think the I think the religious people do get a little bit of a short straw here. It's sort of like, oh no, we're going to Miura, and they're just like, fuck them. It would have been really good if some of the religious people were also capable. Like, you know, yeah. Like there was the old matron who didn't want anyone having sex, and it was all going to be pure and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Well, not having sex, but you know, it's going to keep marriage and morals and stuff. Yeah. But then she was also useless. And Coco, I just looked up, not Croker. Yeah, Coco, and he just goes, yeah, they had a generator down there. They didn't even turn the generator on. And it's like, well, how about one of these things where they could look after people and could keep Christian moral values, but also be good farmers and good with triffids and all that kind of stuff. I think it was a little bit of a...
Yeah, but obviously that was a point of his.
Yeah.
Like, obviously it was a point that when you just follow religious rules in that state,
yeah,
it doesn't really work, because you have to combine... Whether you have to combine practical and religious and surviving stuff,
yeah,
or if you don't do it,
practical ethics, practical ethics in the post-apocalyptic world. Yes. So let's move on to the end, because you said again, we're going over this in a more rough and ready way. We're not following this.
I wanted to add one more thing about what is a major topic in that book is loneliness, which I really like. I really enjoyed.
Yeah,
well, I didn't enjoy that, but it's a good idea actually, because before he met Gisella, and in the time where he wasn't with her, he was alone.
Yes,
and then if you actually just put yourself into thinking, oh, what if a situation like that happens? What would be the worst thing?
Yeah, and
actually, like, being alone in that situation is terrible, because you can't. There's so many things you can't do by yourself.
Mm. Yeah,
it's
not just about can't do it by yourself. It's like, it's this weird thing that as soon as people, and it's mentioned a few times in the book, as soon as people become blind, they're second class citizens, to the point that you can be surrounded by human beings, but because they're blind, they're not. You can't talk to them. You can't do anything with them.
They're not really with you.
They're not really with you. So you can be surrounded by humans. And these could be the most interesting humans in the world, but he only ever sits down and says to one person, tell me your life story. Because if you're blind, it doesn't matter. And I read, just to say this, I actually read the version Audible. Unfortunately, it's an abridged version, but I thought I'd give it a go anyway. This is not as if I need to read the full version of this book to enjoy it. And when they get to the end, there's this guy, is it Brian, who owns the farm that they get to in the end?
Yeah.
Sherning Farm. Anyway, Brian is there.
Yeah.
And in the book, there's this really cool thing, because he's a blind person who knows what's going on.
Like, yeah, he's actually capable.
Yeah, because there's triffids right in front of him.
And he tries.
And it's a really great passage in the unabridged book, because it wasn't in the abridged book. But he makes himself a mask, and he wraps himself up, and he gets a bit of string, and he reels out the string from this baling string, and he reels it out, and he keeps going, and then he gets another one and reels it out further, and he manages to get all the way into town, to a shop, like it's like 5 kilometers away or something like that. And he picks up the stuff, and then he follows the string all the way back to the farm again. And you're like, way awesome. And then you realize, it's worth knowing his story, because he's like the token blind guy who knew what was up and could survive with three blind people in a house surrounded by triffids until Gisella turns up. Like,
woman.
Yeah, with a pregnant wife. Because he needed to. He's like, well, I can't wait for help.
Yeah. And this is like, he's over this point where he's paralyzed,
yeah,
by becoming blind, which is like a surprise for everyone. Nobody's prepared to, oh, tomorrow you're going to be blind, what would you prepare to do? But it suddenly doesn't work. And also because he's in his own house and it's this set environment where he actually quite knows well what is where. It does work well. But he's also going to learn something. He says, oh, I want to learn how to live to be blind.
Yeah.
And I want to learn how to...
But it is amazing. And that's one of the... I think that's one of the most heroic stories in there. And it was a real pity that was cut out of the abridged version, because it got to that point and it was like, yes, because there was 5 people in the house and 2 of them went away and they never came back. And then they stayed in the house. And then Gisella turned up and I was like, wait, he took 2 trips down to the town. It's like this whole chapter which had just been cut out, which actually kind of shortened up the end of the book. Because it's like a 200-page book. But I guess they probably took out maybe 75 pages or something of material, and it's very noticeable. I do suggest, if you're going to read this, get an unabridged version, because you don't really get this full experience. But also what I liked, like you say, like with people waiting for help, I really like this, like, oh, and the Americans will turn up soon. There's this, was it that there's the guy, the radio man, and Elizabeth, his wife, who was like, yeah, where are we going? Oh, well, is it this on the map? It's marked on all the best American maps. I don't worry, we'll be fine there. So when the Americans, of course, the Americans never do turn up, but it's one of those, things where people like have this irrational faith that something will save them. And you said before about just another thing about the end of the book, you were like expecting another big twist or another big reveal or something.
Yeah. So at the end, so they're still in that farmhouse there. And yeah. Then, like, there's several people more. Like, they have this little girl, which also Susan is now part of their little community kind of thing. And they actually get on quite well. They have, like, a really good defense against the Triffids and that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, the electrical fence.
And then who turns up? The army guys or something?
No. There's one group that turns up who are the Isle of Wight group, which is the group from the university. That's the first thing. And they're like, hey, you should come across here and join us on the Isle of Wight. And they're like, they pretty much, yeah, we'll come at the end of the summer. We'll spend the summer here and then we'll come at the end of the summer. That's the idea.
And it's a good idea because I think, like, if you have something that you don't want to have in a certain space, in a certain area, just take an island.
Yes, of course. And this is one of those things where you're like, you're reading through the book and you're like, well, what would I do? Of course, I can't remember ever having not read this book. Well, I can, but you know, I can't remember reading this book for the first time and not knowing that they're all going to be going down to the Isle of Wight at the end of it. You know, it's one of those things that you just go, oh yes, of course, go down to the Isle of Wight.
I mean, it's good that England actually has it's an island itself, but it's good that they have actual additional islands. I mean, what do you do in Germany? You just are like, you can't just put everybody on these islands there in the Baltic Sea.
You can just leave the Berlin Wall up because this is a cold war. We'll be fine in Berlin. No, get out of Berlin. No, I'm sure you could probably do like a similar thing. There's places in just around here where there's canal networks which carve up the country. You know, you could maybe do something like that.
I mean, just go to the Museum's Island.
Museum
Island. Just
it's not really anywhere farming ground there.
Yeah, and no shopping stuff, no food. We would find something.
Yeah, in Berlin, I don't think the Triffids would come that far into Berlin in that way. But no, I reckon you could do this kind of stuff. No, but you wanted like, oh, and then they're going to find a way to defeat the Triffids now.
No. I wanted like a, oh, by accident, they found...
You wanted a War of the Worlds thing, didn't they? Like, oh, and it turns out that the Martians are killed off by the bacteria.
Yeah, or they kill themselves by whatever.
Yeah,
I wanted like a little... Not a hope thing or something, but
no,
I wanted
but
like...
No, there is hope at the end.
And not, yeah, I mean,
because
they
gets
run
to
away.
Place. He's the biologist, and what Koga says, you need the teacher, the professor... the doctor, the teacher, and the professor. If you've got doctors, teachers, and professors, you can have civilization. That's what Coker says. And at the end, he goes to a place and they say, well, I'm not going to tell you about the history of this. You can read the history of this, our history from this. This was the end of my personal history, and now it joins the main history from the new Isle of Wight human community colony. But it's pretty clear that he's the Triffid expert and he's now
going to
work.
He's going to
he's
going to
work
them.
on the Triffid thing. And I reckon in a way, I know this is a weird thing to say, but this is what I was thinking about in bed last night after I'd finished listening to this audiobook. They said, oh, and we've got a leg up because we've got the world and, you know, we've got all the stuff in the world. And I'm thinking now, I'm just like, well, it'd be really difficult for a society or like any kind of civilization to rebuild itself because all of the oil's used up. Like, if we need more oil, we need to get out of the ground. And that's always one of the things that you think, like if all of civilization has to start off again from caveman and we don't know where the oil is, we're not going to find the oil because all the time, all the places where the oil is just coming out of the ground, that's all been used up and all this other point. But with the Triffids, they can use the Triffid oil, if you know what I mean. So actually in this new world, they'll make engines that can run on Triffid oil. They can do all this other kind of stuff with Triffid
oil. But I think like what makes this story so interesting is that when you have the story in the 50s, they have a totally different standard with electricity and environmental responsibility and all this stuff. If that something like that would happen today, it would be totally different. I mean, there's a really good German kind of... It's not really science fiction, but it's like this apocalyptic thing.
Yeah, post-apocalypse thing.
Yeah, it's called Blackout. And it deals with... What would happen if all the electricity would just...
Yeah, you told me about that,
And that would be something you would have to think about. What if you have no electricity? And that would have... I mean, if
my laptop's got a battery, it'll be fine. I can get like 6 hours out of this MacBook Pro.
Okay, and then what happens then?
Yeah,
I mean, we have the motor thing, but
The thing is, what would I connect to if there's no internet, because there's no electricity yet?
Yeah, and so you would have to think about that. I mean, if there's no electricity in our days, you're kind of like...
But that's what I say, this is the time, and I've mentioned this before when I was talking about, when me and Jesse did an episode on time travel, and we were talking about the Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court. That worked because it was written when one person could pretty much know all the world's, well, not all the world's knowledge, but all the practical knowledge about metalworking and chemistry and all that kind of stuff. And after that point, after like the late 19th century, not any one person can keep up to date with all the science and technology and stuff that's happening at the time. And now you have very much specialists, but back then, so they took like a person who was very good with his hands and worked in a factory and took him back 1,000 years and he could get around there. But even now,
I couldn't.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if you take any one person or any one bit of knowledge from the modern day, it will be more specialized than is going to be useful. So I was saying that was a time travel book which worked in their way. Yeah. And that, I think this is a book which, because it's in the 1950s, and because if a truck breaks down, you have to just open up the lid.
And you can
just open up the lid. Like in your car, what happens if, like, say, the starter motor breaks on your car? You just be like, no.
The good thing is it never happened before. Yeah.
Of course, because...
The only thing is why I opened the what's this called?
The lid.
The lid there is to refill
the oil.
You
don't refill your...
No, it's just like this very new car, and just put in the windscreen.
Oh, the windscreen wipe. Yeah, yeah. The windscreen. You lift up, but it's like the same thing. Like if your iPad breaks, you can't do anything. But if your PC breaks, if you had a PC, you could open it up and you could put a new sound card in there. You could replace the mouse. You could put a new keyboard on there. You can even replace the screen. All these other kind of stuff. If your iPad breaks, like that. Mm. And that's what I'm saying about this 1950s technology. That it's believable that one person can get by and learn farming again and learn how to use a tractor and all that kind of stuff. And now today is like planting and plowing things. Yeah, I just get in one of those tractors and go, well, where, what do I,
Also because was it also in the 50s where they have these oil cutouts, or where they had to reduce where they had to like do with the car driving around, they had to say the...
No, it was the 1970s
But still, at these points, people actually had some motors at their homes, as their private private electricity going on. Who has that now?
What, generators?
Yeah, who has a generator?
Well, to be honest, I think a lot of people on the eastern seaboard of America have generators now. With all these hurricanes coming in, I'm not trying to be funny or anything, but if you live now in New York, a lot of these buildings have their generators. You know, they're all like that. But not so much in Europe, because that's why civilization came up in Europe, because we didn't have hurricane. Well, this is one of the it's one of the theories.
Yay!
Is like
Europeans.
But it's true. It's like where does civilization arise? It's where you've got lots of farms and if you do have any flooding, it's regular flooding, like on the Nile in Mesopotamia and those places, and then later on in Greece. It's like Greece, it's great weather. Like when is the hurricane, and there's earthquakes and stuff, but it wasn't like your country wasn't being regularly fucked over by anything, and so that's one of the reasons why I don't know. I'm just saying it's what happens. Anyway.
Okay, I think that's a good point. to go to the movie.
Yeah, so the movie that we watch is from 1962. We watched a few minutes of that, and it's so terrible that we just couldn't let me just check this out. So the first comment here on the YouTube, because you can watch this full Day of the Triffids from 1962 movie on YouTube. It used to be on Google Video, but I guess people uploaded it to here. Once Google Video goes, it goes, the fun days when nurses would light your cigarette and then put you to bed. And it's quite an interesting take. It's like, oh. And of course, Bill Mason is an American, because in a British film like this, they have to have the American as the main star. It's like, don't worry, tomorrow morning you'll be back down to Southampton and back on your ship to America. Ah, gee, thanks, ma'am. Are you really right? Oh, yes. Don't worry, sir.
You'll be fine. Ah, yeah, I'm the hero of the movie, because I'm American. Yeah. Okay, well, you come this way. Anyway, so that's kind of what's going on. And also, it seems like that the main heroine is the scientist, and he's just the hero action figure. Anyway,
yeah.
So we didn't watch that movie, but we did watch what I think is the best version of The Day of the Triffids in movie form, which is 28 Days Later, a movie by director Danny Boyle. And I definitely mentioned this on the... and the last time I reviewed this this book, Day of the Triffids, because I because when I read that, it was the last time I put it this way. The last time I read Day of the Triffids was the first time I'd read the book after watching 28 Days Later. And when I'd watched 28 Days Later, I was like, oh, this is a bit like the Triffids. And then later on, I read The Day of the Triffids, and I was like, wait, it was just like the Triffids. And so I've come to the conclusion that you can't make a good Day of the Triffids movie which is actually faithful to the book. I looked a little bit about this this TV series with the what you're looking for, IMDb. Yeah, okay. When I was looking for, there was a BBC version, and it seems like the BBC version takes more inspiration from the old movie than it does from the actual book. But I don't know. I haven't actually seen that. There it is. Day of the Triffids.
I just wanted to see how many.
Yeah, there's Day of the Triffids, 1981, 1962, 2009.
Did you see that one?
No, that's the one I'm talking about. That's the BBC miniseries version that I was talking about. But I saw a trailer for it, and there's a guy on a plane. Just in this movie, there's a person on a plane, you know, and the plane, it's about planes crashing, because it's a bit more modern, if you know what I mean. Mm. Yeah, look, Doug Ray Scott, Eddie Izzard, Brian Cox, some pretty good, and Vanessa Redgrave, some... pretty good actors in that one. Haven't seen that one, but if we go to 28 Days Later, we watched this just from 2002. Just watched this a few days ago, and I really, really like this movie. Juliana, your opinion? You liked
you
it.
You said it. Like, first of all, it's in the horror movie section in the.
You it was a horror movie.
Yeah, but you said, oh, it's not so bad. It's like the Triffids. Just with zombies. And the last zombie movie we actually watched was Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah. And takes inspiration from this movie, you know, like, yes, walking around a deserted London.
Obviously, yeah. Yes. But to replace the Triffids to replace the Triffids and blind people.
No, it didn't replace, it combined them.
Yeah, it combined them together and replaced them by the whole people just becoming zombies and just like,
well,
killing people, violence, blood.
But that's what you get in the Day of the Triffids book, no, as well.
Not so much. And there was at the end where it was almost to the end of the movie. It's kind of a spoiler for the movie as well. But like, they are in that house with these army guys.
Yeah.
And at the end, the main character just gets to this guy and he just bangs his head against the wall over and over and over again. And that's okay.
Yeah, you could do the blood spraying into his face with banging on the head.
With that, because it was like a really horrific situation. They almost raped all these two women there. I could have got with that. But then he got that man, laid him on the floor and just... pushed his thumb in
both of his eyes, and it's really graphic. It's the closest thing to the camera is him pushing thumbs into the eyes,
and just like it's the same thing with Shaun of the Dead when they are in the pub at the end.
It just took an extra too far,
took that bit too much, and yeah. And then this makes me not enjoying that movie. Anymore.
But it was just that one shot. If that one shot hadn't been in there, you would have liked it.
Yeah. Yes.
So anyway, we watched this movie. We watched this movie 2 days ago, and then yesterday, the day after watching the movie, I listened to the audiobook. Now, this is just from the abridged audiobook, and I made a note of all the things in common. And this is the reason why. If someone was to make a true adaptation of The Day of the Triffids, everybody watching it who'd seen 28 Days Later would just be like, well, you've just remade 28 Days Later. And what actually Danny Boyle did, Danny Boyle...
The Triffids.
Oh, yeah. If they make a Triffids movie, you would say, you've just copied 28 Days Later. You know, if it's true to the book, yeah. It'll be just as true to 28 Days Later. Not all of the elements are in the same place. Not all of the elements are in the same order. But there are so many storytelling elements, character elements, plot elements, locations, and all that kind of stuff. So it is just going through. So in both of them, he wakes up in hospital.
In an empty hospital.
In an empty hospital.
Well, actually, yeah, mostly empty hospital. Deserted hospital, let me put it that way. And then he goes downstairs and there's like these zombie people. Of course, they're blind people, but they're walking around like zombies, like this horde of people moaning like this. So even though the zombies, well, it's not zombies, it's a rage virus, you know, that's why it's not real. It's not a real zombie movie. It's a rage virus in the 28 years later. But it's still got that same like people standing like when he goes into the church and all the people are like this. Mm-hmm. And he says, I made a noise. And people looked at me and they stared at me, but they weren't staring at me, they were staring through me. Again, you get that same imagery right there in the movie. He walks around a silent London. Now, this is a combination of two parts of the book, because later on in the book, he goes back to the London and goes around the silent London. There's a scene in the book, right close to the book, he goes into a bar and there's a man trying to get whiskey and he's like, oh, not that whiskey, let's get the good whiskey, here's the good whiskey, don't get that bottle, get this bottle. And it's exactly the same shot was it Harry, the Brendan was Gleeson's?
Frank?
No, I've got the IMDb right here, his name, it's Brendan Gleeson, oh yeah, Frank, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, my mistake.
What's his guy?
Which one?
The main guy.
Cillian Murphy.
Jim. Oh, it's Jim.
Yeah.
Not Bill.
Bill Mason. No, they changed some of the names around. Yeah. So they do. There's a scene with him picking the right whiskey, like Frank does as well. And then there's the whole "What's the good of money?" which is a line from the book, and you see him picking up money, and you went, "What's the use of that money?" And it's like, "Yeah, okay, we got that one." There's a family, the family of the landlord in the book. His wife, they go and kill themselves, lay down in bed and kill themselves in the same way that Jim in the movie, the main star, he goes to visit his parents and his parents have laid down in bed and killed themselves. Right, that's directly from Triffids as well. Parents lived in the southern London suburb. That's the same in both the movie and the book. It's a man-made disaster, which is kind of true in both books. Of course, there's, like we were saying before, about the conspiracy that it's like, it's me and play gods, scientists going, oh, let's create these Triffids, or let's do these Triffids. Oh, and the Triffids have got out into the world. This. And in the same thing at the beginning of 28 Days Later, it's like, oh, no, don't release these monkeys, apes. They've got the rage. It's really setting up. It's like, okay, guys, here's the rest in the movie. If they touch you, if you get any blood on them, or if you get any is it blood and saliva, then it's like, okay, now that's good, thanks for explaining all that. Desolate and not having no plan, just walking around as well. Oh, Piccadilly Circus. In the book, they go to Piccadilly Circus, and that's like the scene of one of these
where he
gets up, and it's the same there in 28 Days Later. Oh, and he goes into a church and it goes the end is fucking truly nigh. No, is it the end is... What is it?
Yeah, yeah, I think it's...
It's well and fucking truly nigh. The end is nigh. Anyway, and at that same time when he... Because he goes from Piccadilly Circus to there. And the same time in the Piccadilly Circus, someone is preaching the end of the world, the end is nigh. And it says in the book, the day of wrath had already arrived. So that's actually, you know, exactly the same kind of sentiment. And also there you go, oh, it's like, oh, there's this one guy leading these blind people around. And he says, oh, I want a woman. Oh, do you want a woman? Is it woman that you want? And he grabs a woman and gives it to a blind woman and gives it to a blind guy. And that's, of course, comes into it a lot. That's one of the main themes later on in both the book and in the movie as well. Tying up the women. And also there's another one. It says in the book, Gisella, she says, you can't turn monstrous all at once. Now, this is the thing that I really liked about the movie, is that, no, he doesn't turn monstrous all at once. He starts off and he's like, oh, no, I could never leave you. I could never kill anyone. But then throughout the movie, he tests himself, you know, and this is one of those things that we mentioned afterward. He goes into this, of course, you've seen the movie. Spoilers if you haven't. He goes into this diner and there's this young kid there who's obviously got the rage virus, and he just takes out his baseball bat and kills him. And then later on when he talks to the soldier, and the soldier's like, who have you killed to be here? And he's like, what? He says, if you survived this long, you must have killed someone. And he's like, yeah, I killed a kid.
A boy.
I killed a boy. And he's like, yeah, but you had to kill him. It was either him or you, wasn't it? And he's like, And he doesn't answer. And that's when you realise, holy shit, this guy, Cillian Murphy, he
He went into that room. This is what I said, wasn't it?
Yeah, no need that he had to.
Because you were saying, it's like, what's he doing?
What's he doing? Why is he doing that? There was no need that he, like, if you're in a weird situation, why would you put yourself in an even weirder situation to go into a room where it's dark and you don't know and it smells?
He needed to know that he could, if it needed to, and that it was a kid, and that he came out and just wiped off the baseball bat and came out. It's like, what happened? Nothing happened. And then at the end of the movie, you know this guy can, like, he can save the day. He didn't turn monstrous all at once, but you know by the end, he can become what he needs to.
He didn't walk into that house and just shoot all these people. He actually made this zombie that they kept, who they kept there. They used him, and he used them against each other to kill themselves.
Of course, that's the whole point in the book, is that, and this is another thing, which is one of the last things on my list, is that at the end of the book, he uses the Triffids to trap the, because there's two enemies in both the movie, and this is another thing they've got in common, both the movie, there's the human enemies and then the rage virus enemies, like the zombie enemies. And in the book, there's the human enemies, And the Triffids. Yeah. And in both of them, he uses the non... He makes like an alliance with the non-human enemy to defeat the enemy. So he kind of... like in both the movie and the book, they kind of use the other side or go over to the other side. In the book, it's there. And I really like the kind of like... there's this like this this three-pronged thing, and you kick away one prong.
Yeah.
And... or you remove yourself and the other two kind of collapse in on each other. That kind of three-way thing. It's in the book, but it's just one scene in the book, and in the movie it's the whole it really focuses on this kind of thing.
But actually, like, I really enjoyed it a lot more in the book, because it's like it's clever.
But he's clever in the movie. He's just brutal. He knows that to defeat the human enemy, he has to become the non-human enemy, more brutal than them. I think that's very, very clearly, and that's what I really liked about this, is like, it says in the book, you don't become, what is it? It says, you can't turn monstrous all at once. This is a movie about a guy waking up, and he's the most human person in that situation. Like, he doesn't know what to do. Like, he's going, oh, I want to go back to my parents and all this kind of stuff. And by the end of the movie, like, he knows that, like, he's going to be this super skinny guy, totally covered in blood. He's the opposite of all action heroes in any movie. Yeah. The action hero should have been, like, Christopher Eccleston, you know, who's the hero guy, the army guy. He's like, yes, here I am, I'm the army guy. And it's a story about like these non-action hero people saving the day, like the girl, the fat dad, the black girl who's pretty cool and running around, but then she goes in the opposite direction. She has to meet Cillian Murphy in the way, Naomi Harris. Miss Moneypenny, spoiler. So she starts off, it's like, no, I will leave you. I will fucking kill you. If you even look like you've got this virus, I'm going to chop your... I'm going to hit you with this baseball bat and stab you with this thing. And in the end, she's the one in the dress. You know, she takes this different direction.
Yeah,
and she's the one. She's the one who has to be saved by Cillian Murphy. So they do this, like, this swapping over thing.
Yeah.
So, carrying on with this list of stuff that's up. Tied up woman, you can't turn monsters all at once. Yeah. What else have you got? And there's another scene where it's this weird one where they're in that apartment, and these couple come out of the apartment and turn and throw themselves out the window. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And he says, "I love you," and then dies. And it's the same thing with, spoiler, Frank, when he says, he turns to is it Hannah, the daughter, and is like, I love you.
I really love you.
You know, the same kind of thing, not directly from the book. Can you cook? And this is another thing, I mentioned that before, like, Trisella, can you cook? Boiled egg standard. And then in the movie, just as they've eaten boiled eggs, or is it omelets or something, the soldier turns to the girls and say, can you cook? Just after eating eggs, and I can't believe that's, like, there can't be this many coincidences. They get dressed up in clothes in a house. At one point in the book, Drusilla says, I mean, thank you. And it's the same in the movie, that same kind of thing. There's a radio broadcast, it's in the movie, in the book it's mentioned. The light on the tower, again, the signal light, that's there in both of them. The manor house with walls and a gate, and later on in the book there's a fortified manor, and it even says there was machine gun emplacements and all that kind of stuff in there. A young girl joins the
party.
We shouldn't forget, like, we should have mentioned at the beginning that we also do, like, quite a spoiler of 28 Days Later.
Fuck it, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter. If you've read Day of the Triffids, 28 Days Later, nothing comes as a surprise to you. Well, maybe a little bit. Like, except just the depths of the violence at the end, which is kind of,
Also, what with the movie is, like, you have this really violent, almost at the end.
Oh, let's get to that bit as well.
And then it turns and it's like this, and there's help.
Also in the both of them, there's what our children won't see. There's the plane coming again and them waving at the plane. That's in both of them. The soldiers rebuilding, letting non-humans kill the human enemy. Driving through the gates is the second to last scene in both of them. At the end of Day of the Triffids, they drive through the gates and the Triffids come in and kill them. And at the end of the book, they drive through the gates and it pauses. Now, like I say, that ending, when they drive through the gates, that was the original end to the movie, and it cuts off there, and you're like, no, they can't end there. And then the title comes up, another 28 days later, ends. They're in the farmhouse on the top of the hill by the lake.
It was not really well made.
No, it's a bit
like
clunky.
A bit like, oh, and then for all the women who watch that movie, we have to put like a nice bit at
and they're making stuff out of curtains and the sewing and dresses.
No zombies around, and the zombies didn't go so far because they actually then died because they had no more food or something.
You wanted a bit, like, at the end of the movie, after that horrific stuff in that movie, it is the change of tone. You're just like, oh, well, why don't they just have a song and dance number here at the end?
So the weird thing about the movie ending is that the horrific, very violent, bloody end was a bit too much to then go down to that very la-la-la-la-la ending. They should have just made, like, a thing in the middle, like, put together, like, a normal...
Like, how they got up there or something.
Whatever. But not, like, from this up-high violent point down to that, like...
It's really funny how you're saying the violent point is the high point and then the next bit is the low point, because, in a way, if you're going to think about the emotions, you'd say the violence is really low and stuff like that, and then when they get rescued at the end, it's like, really high! But you're actually saying it the other way around. I know what you mean. You're, like, saying the tension, the drama, the energy was, like, when he's broken into the house. Yeah, your disgust comes all the way down, and it's like, la-la-la-la-la-la.
Yeah. But then also, I must remind you that when I finished The Triffids, which happened before I've seen 28 Days Later.
You read The Triffids.
I read The Triffids before, and then I complained about the ending.
Yes, you said it was a bit twee, and this is what I want to talk about. I've got the book here, John Wyndham, this omnibus. It got The Day of the Triffids, the Kraken Wakes, or the Kraken, depending if you've seen the Pirates of the Caribbean, they call it the Kraken. Anyway, apparently the first person to say it on screen didn't know how to pronounce it and just said Kraken. And then for the rest of the movie, everyone said Kraken and instead of Kraken. And then the Chrysalids. Now, the Chrysalids is another post-apocalyptic way, way later, you know, like way, way after, you know, nuclear holocaust. And that's, again, very comfy and it's very cozy. And this is what people say about John Wyndham, is that he writes these cozy, comfortable apocalypses. It's like, yes, we'll do this, but we can still, you know, get dressed up and do this. And then we're going to live in a farm and it's all very nice. It's the return to, like, you know, this...
the civilized way.
Yes, not a, I was going to say, bucolic kind of existence, and everyone lives on farms, everyone's getting on, and you've got a wife at home, and the man's out in the field doing the work, and it's the same with the Chrysalids as well. And I totally understand that this is the tone of the book. When you get to the end of the book, it doesn't matter how horrific it is, and you realise, oh, those soldiers there, they just killed them. And of course, the soldier that they meet at the end, you'd met one of them earlier on. It was the redhead guy who shot the guy. You know, there'd already been a meeting there. Yeah. And he knew what kind of person. It wasn't like, oh, we'll just leave these guys to die just because minor disagreement. Let's just kill them. No, he knew what they were getting into, and they were actually getting out of a big hole there.
Yeah.
With having their farm overrun by...
Yeah, it was the only way to get out of there.
That's what they thought. They said, we're not going to... He said, if we leave this to the morning, we can't do it. We need to sort this out now.
Yeah.
And again, that's another scene where when he's in the movie as well, he's like, let's go now, you know, and he grabs them and starts running out and he doesn't get anywhere. And that's the same kind of, okay, ladies, we've got to save the ladies now. Let's go now. Let's get them out.
Yeah.
So that's in there, and I totally understand that. Like, when you get to the end of, and that's because you mentioned that to me before we watched 28 Days Later. I was like, oh, just wait until the end of 28 Days Later; they do it much better. And you realize, oh, this is not cozy. You see Manchester burning. You see like nothing going on. And when you see that table scene where there's eight soldiers,
one guy and two ladies, actually, and you just looked at him and went, they're the only women there. And I'm like, yeah.
I have no idea how men feel like when they watch that scene, but you, as a woman, you feel this. You're like, actually, like, you really, yeah. actually, like, you feel so much like these two women feel there. Like,
yes.
The, all the emotions, just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
What could, there's no way they could do anything. And then they yeah. just had to go with that situation. And then this is why she gives her the pills, because it's yeah. the only way. Okay, you have to accept it. Just try to make you.
It's like, hey, tonight, get ready to be raped. I mean, it's like, just one of those things. No, like, multiple.
Like,
and just
no.
But
don't.
It's so weird. Christopher Eccleston is just like, I promise them women. I'm not, you can go. I'm not giving up the women. And you're just like,
oh my God.
No.
Oh my God.
You
no.
can't.
And what, at this point, like, you already had the, kind of that idea.
Oh yeah, you knew what you were getting into. But this is the point where you, when they arrived at that blockade, again, massive spoiler, when they arrived at the blockade, there's other cars there. Other yeah. cars have arrived at the blockade. Were there no women in those other cars? And you've got to think, yeah, there were no women in those other cars. That's why you don't see anyone but the soldiers, because when the other men came along...
Also, at the beginning, when they actually arrived in that manor, I said, oh, the... Now they are like they are the only women there.
Yeah,
I actually
yeah.
said that
yeah,
without
already,
having that in
already
mind
knew.
That this would be like a
the main thing.
A
but thing. That's the thing in all of these well not all these post-apocalyptics, but in many of these post-apocalyptic things, women suddenly become the main currency in a way,
that's
and property. It just drops. You just
yeah.
go back 1,000 years, and you're just like, okay, women, get ready because you are now commodities to be traded and moved around and put
yeah, and
with
not
people.
Not only that, you just go to be like a birth machine.
Yeah, baby machine, which is what the university group, you know, who end up in the Isle of Wight, they acknowledge that. They acknowledge, okay, women are going to have babies,
yes.
but they
do it like the women just
yes,
decide,
it's like,
okay.
And it's like, women, do you want to come with us? And like a number
yeah.
of them don't, but then again, it's telling that the only sighted people who stay with the Christians were the women. You know, it's a strange
yeah.
thing. But even at the end, when he, you know, when at the end of the Day of the Triffids, when the ginger guy talks, like the soldier talks to Bill Mason, which is like the head of the southeast quadrant of this thing. Anyway, he comes along then, he says, "Oh, and you'll get these women, and you'll get this thing, and when all the babies grow up, you'll be in charge." And it's like, "Oh, so I'm going to be the tribal leader?" And he's like, "Yes, that's what all men want, isn't it? They want their own tribe. They want 10 women to have and to impregnate, and this will be your tribe of all your progeny here." And you're just
it's like in Neanderthals.
Yeah.
And this is like an interesting thing. It's like what makes our society different to Neanderthals?
Yeah.
Nothing really. If everything of the modern world cuts out, you're left.
Are we back to, like, are women going to be beaten? And anyway, it's a weird thing. Anyway, so this was... I think a really interesting, like, watching the movie brings out more about the Day
about
of the Triffids.
About the book, yes.
Yeah, and also reading the book brings out more about the Day of the Triffids, because, it explains, you know, where different situations, different scenes, it goes a bit more into the different, different political setups. And
actually, when you watch the movie, you will definitely enjoy the book even more.
You think?
Yeah.
Why, because it's like a visual representation?
Like it's like you have plants, you don't have zombies. You have not humans. You have blind people turning blind, but they not like they are.
No, but I understand what they do. You combined deadly poisonous plant
yeah.
zombies with
blind people,
and you create.
Yeah.
Well,
you create zombies.
You create.
Of course,
it's like this is the reason why I think the it's a very interesting book, because, like, as I started off this whole review, there's these two main features: there's Triffids and blind people. There's these two threats. Or not these two threats. There's a problem and a threat. And by combining
and,
the problem
and
the threat into one thing...
You shouldn't forget that also in the book there's this this disease coming, which also kills...
Yes, yes,
then
that's, yeah, that kills off all the people.
Seeing
yeah,
people can
yeah, yeah.
be infected as well. So
no, I don't think so.
Oh, yeah?
There's not a single seeing person gets infected.
No?
Nope, no seeing people ever... There's no reference of any seeing person getting infected by the virus, which is one of those things that you think, oh, maybe it's got something to do with it, but it's never mentioned. I listened out for it. Of course... I was only listening for in the abridged version, but I did actually listen out to it yesterday when I listened to the book again.
And like the religious woman, was she seen?
Yeah, she could see, the religious woman could see, and they had like four other girls
yeah.
there with
and
them.
She died.
Oh, the religious woman
yes.
died.
Yes. So
ah.
this disease also killed. Like that was then another major point
okay.
why they had to escape from cities and
yeah.
why they had to escape from, because this disease
okay.
turned up
okay.
and that also killed seeing people.
Okay, you're probably right about that. Maybe in the abridged version that wasn't cleared up. Anyway, I think that's all we need to talk about really here, because I think that's a good discussion about this book. Should we say what's coming up next on the podcast? Our next, I'm going to do a review of World War by Harry Turtledove and Manhattan in Reverse, which is a short story collection by Peter F. Hamilton. And so I'll be doing those over the next few days as well, because I've been busy with other things, another video editing project, which has taken up a lot of time, and other writing projects and other video editing projects. But now I can get back into doing some more podcasts. The next book that we're going to review as a two-person podcast will be Solaris.
Yeah.
Shall we run down what we've done so far?
Yeah, we could. So I read the German ebook.
So we done a Polish to German ebook.
Yeah.
I did the... I've listened to the Polish to English
audiobook,
and now I've read the Polish to French to English paper book. We've watched the 1972 movie or 1971?
Yeah.
Polish to Russian movie by Tarkovsky. With English subtitles, so it's Russian to the Polish to Russian and then to English again. And I listened to the BBC audio drama, which I really recommend. It's awesome. That's the one, if you've read Solaris before and you want to keep up with it, you can find that on the BBC iPlayer or... you can buy it from Amazon, or apparently there's ways to get it via the internet for free, and that's really good. So that's actually an adaptation of the English. That's an adaptation of the Polish to French to English audio book, which has been adapted in that way. And the final thing that we're going to do is we're going to watch the next Solaris by Soderbergh with
what? I wanted to say Sean Connery.
With George Clooney. And so that's the final thing. So once we watch that movie, we're going to do a super in-depth... We're going to say, you have to have at least read one of these books before listening to that podcast.
At least having contact with Solaris.
Yeah, you somehow need to know about Solaris, because we're not going to be going over the plot. We're going to talk about the different ways it's been interpreted and what we liked about the book and what we liked about the different movies. It's going to be really in-depth into all of these different things.
Yeah.
So that's coming up next. I'm just saying, your homework is to... I would suggest, do not read the Polish to French to English translation. The version on Audible is way better. It's really, really good. And I know that because for about a third of the book, I was listening to the audiobook, one translation of the audiobook, the Audible audiobook, of course, and I was reading along with it. And in so many ways, we'll go into this in the next part, so many ways, the paper book is far, far inferior because it's been translated through two different languages. So I do suggest going to Audible, and you can get this book for free. Why not? Sign up. SFBRP is the coupon code or whatever you need. Actually, you need to go to Audible. Is it Audible Trial?
Yeah.
audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And if you do that, you can sign up for a free trial. And the way it works is that there's 100,000 different audiobooks that you can get there, you know, like, 10,000 different science fiction and fantasy books. I don't know how many, but they've got great stuff. And what Audible did is because they knew that Solaris, the translation, was really, really rubbish. The English translation was really rubbish. So they got somebody to do a better translation and then did an Audible. And it's the only version you can get of this. The only way to get it is through audible.com. So if you go to, it says right here, audibletrial.com/SFBRP, sign up for a free trial. You get like 14 days or 30 days or something. And then like this free trial that you did with this book thing that you got. If you don't want it after, you can listen to Audible, this book, no problem. But I reckon once you get into Audible and start listening to these Audible books, you can do that. You can listen to an abridged version of Triffids. Maybe the full version is on there, but in my territory in Germany, I don't seem to get that. But no, I listen to loads of Audible books, and it's a great way to get through stuff. So, check out that offer. It helps support this podcast. And anyway, I think that's about it. Goodreads.com, you can become my friend on there, and you can become Juliana's friend on there. You can follow me, and also you can sign up for the SFBRP listeners group and discuss Solaris and discuss this book if you want to, and all that other kind of stuff. I think that's about a bit. We've gone over an hour now. Anything else you want to say?
No. I think I made all my points very clear.
Yes, you did. You want to take out the eye gouging shot. If you just take out that, you'd have enjoyed the movie. But he had to turn monstrous.
No, you know,
because he turned to Miss Moneypenny and said, "Hey, the scarecrow turns to Miss Moneypenny and says, "Hey, you said you would kill me if you even thought for a moment that I was going to be turning," and then they kissed.
I think that's a good end point.
Good. You need that. You don't turn monstrous all at once. Anyway, read Day of the Triffids. It's really good fun. I'm going to stick with my 4.5 rating from before. I'm gonna leave it as a 4.5 rated book. And again, I think my enjoyment of the book, like you said, my enjoyment of the book goes up after watching 28 Days Later, like immediately after. Well, no, like I watched 28 Days Later and then listened to the audiobook. Even though I listened to the abridged audiobook, I've read this book so many times, I don't need to know every scene. It was really good just to make some notes about the similarities and how much they reflect on each other and how much it increases enjoyment. So that's it from me. Say goodbye, Juliana.
Goodbye.
And I'll catch you next time.